The second term of President George W. Bush began just a little over 3 hours ago. This hour, we'd like to focus on what's ahead for the next 4 years. We want to spend most of our time talking about domestic issues. The White House has made it clear the president has an expansive domestic agenda. What we'd like to know from you is this. What can be done in the next 4 years on the domestic front to make your life better? Changes in Social Security, an improvement in the health care system, changes one way or the other, in taxes. Give us a call. We have two lines today, one for Republicans, the other for Democrats. If you're a Republican or lean Republican and would like to join the conversation, the number is 800-344-3893. If you're a Democrat or lean Democratic, the number is 800-344-3864. That's 800-344-3893 for Republicans, and for Democrats, 800-344-3864. The email address is the same for everybody, TOTN@NPR.org. Before we switch to domestic issues, we'll also talk a bit about foreign policy, which was much of the focus of the president's inaugural address today. And before we do that, we want to check in on the inauguration parade. After his inauguration address, the president enjoyed lunch on Capitol Hill and has now made his way to a limousine, which is making its way down Pennsylvania Avenue. NPR's Brian Naylor is at the staging area for the inaugural parade. Aren't you at the reviewing stand, Brian?
Actually, I'm at the reviewing stand, Neil, at the end of the parade. It's still about, I don't know, probably 20 minutes or a half hour before it gets to us. But this is where the president will wind up. I'm standing in a booth directly across the street from the reviewing stand, which is on Pennsylvania Avenue, right in front of the White House. It's a big white and blue structure with steel beams and bulletproof glass and all kinds of bristling with security.
And it's a chilly day here in Washington, D.C., dusted with snow. The temperature's right around the freezing mark. How's the crowd holding up?
Well, they're doing fine. They've actually only begun, they only began filing in the last hour or so. They haven't quite been here too long after the inaugural ceremonies, the swearing in on the Capitol. They began filing in through security. And this is definitely the VIP section where the swells, if you will be the folks who contributed large sums to the president's campaign, a lot of members of Congress. Karl Rove, a few moments ago, walked into the reviewing stand and got a big round of applause from the people who appreciate his work on behalf of President Bush. They've been entertained in the last half hour or so by the PA announcer, so if you hear some loud voice telling corny jokes in the background, that's who that is. And there are a lot of helicopters overhead and police and military personnel standing, not quite shoulder to shoulder, along Pennsylvania Avenue, keeping an eye on the crowd.
There are some protesters who've gotten some seats along the parade route, but not where you are, I take it.
Not where I am, or at least if so, they haven't made themselves visible yet. This has been a pretty difficult area to get into. Lafayette Park, which is directly behind me, has been closed off, and there are several checkpoints I had to go through, pat down and magnetometers and several other checking of my clearances and my security, my badges, to make sure that, you know, I was all right. So it's not easy. This is not an easy area to get into.
Well, in, I guess, what, 10 or 15 minutes from now, the head of the parade will reach you. It's led by a phalanx of police on motorcycles and then all kinds of color guards and pageantry that is going to be marching past you for much of the rest of the day. If we can, we'll check in with you later, Brian.
Well, I hope so. There'll be a lot of bands. We can perhaps listen to some music later on.
Let's hope so. NPR's Brian Naylor at the reviewing stand on the parade route along Pennsylvania Avenue. With a second-term president, a concern for legacy is always part of the package. While only history can judge President Bush, it is also history that gives us a sense of what he faces. Joining us now from Capitol Hill is Richard Cohn, head of the curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Nice to be with you.
You study a specific type of president, among which President Bush is counted, the war president.
Yes, that's correct. He's declared himself a war president. He doesn't always behave that way, but the political leadership and the country seems to accept him as such.
The war is defined differently by different groups. Republicans tend to see the war on terror as including the war on Iraq. Democrats see that differently.
Yes, that's been a divisive thing, Neil. I think that the president did see it in many respects as part of the war on terror. He certainly insisted upon that. But there's a good deal of evidence that this administration had Iraq in its crosshairs from the very beginning. So I think we really won't know until hopefully someday we see the documents and people are more forthright in their interviews.
And we'll also have to see how things turn out in Iraq. Of course, a key turning point, or what may be one, coming up in just less than 2 weeks' time, the presidential elections there.
Yes, I think so. But whatever the origins of our intervention and attack on Iraq, I do think it has now become significant in the war, the larger war against radical Islamist terrorists, simply because we've made it so. Certainly others from around the Muslim world have come to Iraq to fight the United States. We've made it a measure of our success. And the president's inaugural address certainly made democratization into the prime foundation for American security in the future. And so he gambled with Iraq, and he's pushed all his chips to the center of the table on Iraq, and only time will tell the extent to which it can succeed.
Hold on just a second, Richard Cohn, if you would. Joining us now is NPR's Libby Lewis. She's along the parade route on Pennsylvania Avenue. And Libby, as I understand it, the president's motorcade is about to reach the point where you are.
Yes, Senator Lott just passed us. There's Senator Fritz. Giving a warm welcome and a hearty welcome at the same time. Tom DeLay. You can tell I'm right in the thick of it.
it's interesting to hear Republican leaders in Congress being greeted as if they were rock stars. Libby, that's a very interesting sound, but I think it's straining the capacities of your cell telephone. Thanks very much for that update along the parade route along Pennsylvania Avenue. Richard Cohn, let's get back to you. The president, in his speech today, described the war to spread freedom, and he put it in the context, it seemed to me, as the same context as a war to contain Nazism or the war to defeat communism, the next great goal. He spoke of the ultimate goal of ending tyranny in our world. The language that he used, some would see as a challenge to allies, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, Egypt, and some would see as a challenge to, the other two members of the old triumvirate of terror, and that's North Korea and Iran.
Well, yes, one wonders whether it's not a challenge to China also, Neil. The speech was very much reminded me of Wilsonian rhetoric from Woodrow Wilson to make the world safe for democracy. It was all phrased, of course, in defensive terms. That is, the only way we'll be safe, or our freedom and democracy will be safe, is if we make everyone else free and democratic. There were some hedges in there. We understand their cultural differences. We're not going to try to impose our system on others. But he did phrase it in the same rhetoric, the same stakes as World Wars I and II and the Cold War. And it is very threatening, I think, to other parts of the world. My fear is that he is overreaching. He's setting a standard for our own security that's both unnecessary and unattainable. And the real question is whether he's overreaching domestically also, for a very strong partisan agenda. And normally war presidents subordinate or even abandon their domestic agenda in order to prosecute the war.
Trying to run, some would say, a war on the cheap. Others would say the United States, with its huge economy, is well able to both build American prosperity at home and continue to wage the war in Iraq.
Well, no doubt we are, but the question is, what happens if you bankrupt the United States' governmental capacity with tax cuts and huge borrowings to change the Social Security system and unscripted, unintended expenditures for a war in Iraq and elsewhere? The president used to say against Al Gore it was fuzzy math. Well, this is pretty fuzzy, too. And the American people in recent polls don't believe it.
And the costs of the war are not insubstantial. Some $100 billion dollars thus far. Of course, 1,400 Americans killed, 10,000 or so wounded in the war, and uncounted thousands of Iraqis.
Yes, there are very great costs to this. I think we can hope that Secretary or soon-to-be Secretary Rice, in her confirmation hearings, emphasizing diplomacy, suggests that for all the vaulting rhetoric of the inaugural address, that this administration does have a different course of action in mind, that it understands that the war against terrorists is not to be a military war, and that we cannot militarize our foreign policy if we're really to be safe.
Richard Cohn, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Richard Cohn is working on a book about war presidents. He currently heads the curriculum on peace, war, and defense at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And he was kind enough to join us by telephone today. Up next today, we'll switch focus and get on to the key domestic issues that face the president in his second term. And, of course, we'll be taking your calls. What advice do you have for the president? What would make your life better on a day-to-day basis? Better health insurance? Better paying job? Give us a call. Better paying job would do that for most of us. Our number, if you're a Republican, is 800-344-3893. If you're a Democrat, 800-344-3864. Again, that's 800-344-3893 for Republicans and 800-344-3864 for Democrats. You can also send us email. The address is the same for everybody, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Cohn, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. For the next 20 minutes or so, we want to talk about domestic issues on the president's second-term agenda and find out what's on your mind. We're taking your calls. What would make your life better from day to day? Help paying those college bills? Or do you have a small business that needs a tax break? Maybe on health insurance. Don't forget about our special phone lines today. Republicans, 800-344-3893. Democrats, 800-344-3864. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And let's get a listener on the line. On the Republican line, this is Bill, who's with us from Asheville, North Carolina.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well.
Two things that bother me, even though I voted for Bush, is his free trade policies, which have tended to make communist China a very wealthy nation, which may turn around to bite us. And as a taxpayer, I may end up spending a lot of money to fight them sometime. I'm in North Carolina. We've had a tremendous amount of loss of jobs here. And the other thing is all the number of illegal immigrants that we have here. And, of course, I know both of these things are supposed to benefit me as a consumer, which they may in the short term. In other words, my table might be bussed and it might save me some money at a restaurant by an illegal alien. Or I might go and buy a Chinese product, which is much cheaper than what the American-made product. But as I see my neighbors losing their job, I begin to realize somebody has to pick up the difference. And tab-wise, I'll pay taxes to do that. The technology that the last administration allowed to be transferred to communist China, I may have to spend extra tax money to develop new weapons to defend us. Follow me to no end.
Yeah, Bill, some people believe that if you build up prosperity in China, you build up a middle class. A middle class will inevitably create demand for greater democracy.
And as we bring our standard of living down, that might happen, you know, and our standard of living goes down. And the same thing with the illegal immigrants coming in. I would say that they're suppressing the wages of the workers here. And I believe that the work would be done no matter whether these people came here. They worked into the system. They could be worked back out. You may pay a higher wage for it. But, yep. You know, if we're fully employed, then you're not taking money from the government, the dole. It comes from, the free market system.
Bill, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate you taking the time today.
One other thing I'd like to say is the sham of the Posse Comitatus law. You know, we can't use the military to guard the border down there, but we have the military, I'm sure, flying over Washington, patrolling Washington, and they did the same thing at the Winter Olympics.
The Posse Comitatus law makes it illegal for the military to have police powers inside the borders of the United States. And, Bill, a lot of people think that's a fundamental framework
and
of democracy.
They use the military to guard the border, though.
Well, that's
inside the border, but guard it.
All right,
that's
Bill.
That's my point.
Thanks very much.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Let's get a caller on the Democratic line, and this is Terry. Terry's calling from Cleveland.
Hello. Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know what the president and the Republican Party is going to do to help the single males now. You know, we have a lot of women and programs for them. I'm out of work right now. It's hard to get anything going for yourself when you start. You can't go back to college. You can't afford it. You got to pay your bills, and it's a little hard. You're making $35,000 a year, and you still can't make it.
The president talked a lot in his inaugural address today about an ownership society, about spreading numbers of people who own their own homes and own things like stocks. Is that something that appeals to you at all?
Yes, it is. But first, you have to get through. I'm a diabetic. I have medicine bills, which are not covered by, you know, by insurance. You have to pay for that stuff. It's just the fact of having to pay your living. You're paying out so much dollars in taxes, more than you're making, actually, to stay alive and be able to function in society. Can't work two jobs now.
Terry, thanks very much for the call. We wish you good luck.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And joining us now to talk about some of these domestic issues is Michael Duffy, Time Magazine's Washington Bureau Chief. He's with us by phone from his office here in Washington. Good to have you on the program again, Michael.
Nice to be here, Neil.
It's hard to miss all the talk of Social Security in an inaugural address that was very short on specifics. That was one of the few things the president did emphasize today.
Right. I think there were maybe two paragraphs about domestic policy issues. And one of them was about essentially about Social Security. And in a speech about freedom, the president said that he wanted to extend the freedoms at home, including the freedom to sort of take greater ownership of your lives and our homes and our schools and our liberty and all of that stuff. And he mentioned in very vague detail, just saying, you know, he wanted to reform the great institutions that made us free in the first place. And on that, he was talking about Social Security.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is there are other things, tort reform, maybe tax reform as well, that the president wants to do in his second term. Social Security seems to be number one, yet it's already running into considerable friction.
Right. And inside his own party, that's what's interesting. No one really expected Democrats to get on board proposals. But what's happened in the last couple of weeks, and particularly this week, is that Republicans, including a leading Republican in the House, Bill Thomas, the Ways and Means Chairman, has said, you know, this thing isn't going very far, very fast the way we're talking about it. He didn't say it was dead. He just said if it continues to go to talk about it the way we're talking about it, it will be dead soon because it's just getting too nasty and too partisan. And Thomas said something I think that a lot of people in Washington have been thinking for a long time, which is that this is going to be hard to actually legislate.
And the president said after his election that he had just earned a great deal of political capital. It looks as if he may have to spend a great deal of it if he's going to win on this issue.
Both men may be right. Thomas is right almost certainly that it's going to be a difficult thing to find the votes for in both houses. And Bush, I see no other item on his domestic agenda other than the budget that he has really put any chips behind. It's always wrong to underestimate this president, and he may spend that capital he's talking about. So they both may be right, actually.
Well, let's get some more listeners involved in the conversation. We have a call from Joyce on the Republican line in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hello.
Hi, Joyce. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah. My just immediate response when I heard your question was we have a small business. And our health care costs, we've always provided 100% for our employees. We have just 10 employees, but it's been amazing how the cost has gone up and up, and it just makes it pretty hard on everybody. And so that's just something that if there was even a tax deduction for the cost of health care or something would be wonderful, but I know we don't have a lot of money in this country right now, it seems like. So I'm not necessarily wanting to whine about it either. So.
Well, I wonder, Joyce, how much does the cost of health insurance factor in if you're deciding whether or not to hire an extra person on board?
Well, it factors in. I think then we also need really, we have an automotive repair shop, and we need really skilled people, and that's kind of hard to find. So it all is a part of the package that you want to offer, of course. And so not everybody offers 100%. So that does factor in, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Joyce, thanks very much, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Bye-bye.
The phone call. Michael Duffy, any chance of some of those health care issues coming up in the next term?
Neil, the way this is working today, I'm not hearing the question completely, but I know that health care is not really on the president's agenda this year. He's put Social Security ahead of it, and I think cutting the budget deficit and immigration at home. Those are the big domestic things that he's laid out, and, of course, any domestic repercussions on Iraq. But the president feels, I think, this is what they say at the White House, that they did their health care piece last year when they did a, quote-unquote, reform of Medicare, extending a drug benefit, creating a drug benefit, excuse me. Now a lot of Republicans and Democrats in Congress think that that was too big and too expensive and needs to be fixed already. But I don't see any others on the agenda this year other than perhaps cutting Medicaid.
And that may or may not be coming up. Michael, stay with us. We'll try to fix that line so you can hear me a little bit better. In the meantime, we're going to go back to NPR's Brian Naylor. He's at the reviewing stand along the parade route on Pennsylvania Avenue. And is the head of the parade there yet, Brian?
Well, it is. The police escort is here. There is a phalanx of Metropolitan Police motorcycles. These are the Washington, D.C. local police, sort of in a V formation, the width of Pennsylvania Avenue. Behind that is an honor guard I can see with, I think it represents the Washington, D.C. police. We still haven't seen the president's limousine turn the corner from 15th Street onto Pennsylvania Avenue, but it can't be too far behind at this point.
Well, Brian, through the miracle of television here in the studio, I can see the president's car, and I can describe it. It's interesting. It's a brand-new model of Cadillac limousine bearing the license plates USA 1.
All right. Well, yeah, I did see some pictures of that, and it's escorted by Secret Service members. You know, it's interesting. I was wondering to see if the president was going to get out at any point along the parade route, but perhaps security just concerns just preclude that this year. That's something that presidents have done, I guess, ever since Jimmy Carter's inaugural back in 1977. But it could be that it was just determined that security concerns were too much in the present to allow that this year.
Mm-hmm. We know that there are protesters along the parade route, some of whom are turning their backs on the president as the motorcade goes by and holding up signs bearing various messages. And, of course, we'll be keeping an eye on all of that. Brian, have a great time today.
Well, thanks very much, Neil.
Brian is at the prime viewing area for the inaugural parade. That's the reviewing stand on Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's get back to Michael Duffy and back to more of your calls. And let's go to this is now on the Democratic line, Tom. And he's also calling, as our last caller did, from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Hi there. It's good to be on the show. You know, what I find very interesting, to me, in the next 3 to 4 years, what we've got to deal with is the health care crunch. We've got so many seniors who are frustratingly dealing with this issue. I have parents, and I'm sure I will be a caregiver, and how are we going to deal with this?
Obviously, this is a situation that a lot of people face, Tom, and in your personal life, this is going to be an issue for you. How do you see it playing out politically?
Very interesting. Just from the comments that I've heard in the last couple minutes, It seems as if it's not a priority. However, if you look at healthcare today, recently in Michigan, we just saw a major institution, a hospital, go bankrupt because of these very issues.
Yep.
So the question is we either we do something today or we do something tomorrow, and the tomorrow is going to be a far greater problem than if we deal with it ahead of time.
Tom, we wish you good luck, too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the phone call. Michael Duffy, of course, anecdotal, but it's interesting that we've had calls from both a Republican and a Democrat, both concerned about health care issues. It's something that a lot of people say in public opinion polls they care about, yet not, as you mentioned earlier, on the president's agenda.
And it wasn't much on the agenda in the fall election. That always surprises me. I think that both parties have been spooked by this issue since, really, for 10 years, since Hillary Clinton tried her huge overhaul in 1993. It died almost within days of its announcement. And ever since then, our national government has really been unable to even wrap its arms around the problem. There have been efforts to extend health insurance to children and to broaden it for seniors. But in terms of a wholesale approach, Washington has been stymied. And now obviously there are a lot of people who want it stymied, perhaps. But how long it can remain that way, I just don't know. It is a mystery to me that it hasn't been a bigger issue.
We're speaking with Michael Duffy of Time Magazine and taking your calls on this Inauguration Day. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get another caller on the line. Brian is with us, and Brian's on the Republican line from Reading, Pennsylvania.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Very well, thank you.
I guess, you know, make my life a little better. I guess, you know, the little bit of a tax burden would be eased, would make things a lot easier. And also just being able to, being a sole proprietor, small business, to have more programs for a white male to be able to get some of these grant programs and these government programs, because I'm not really a minority, but I feel like I am.
So there are set-asides, what you're saying, contracts and various sorts of things that are set aside for minority-owned businesses. You'd either like to see some for white male groups or the set-asides taken away.
I'm born and raised in America, and it's been hard ever since. I mean, but if you come into America as an immigrant, you seem to have a little bit easier time of getting a franchise, getting up and running, not have to pay taxes for a few years until you're up and running. I never had that advantage.
A lot of immigrants would disagree with you on that point, Brian, but we can argue about that forever. There have been tax cuts every year that George Bush has been president. More, you say?
Well, not really more, I guess, focused. More focused tax breaks, depending on what they're for. Maybe giving small disadvantaged businesses a little bit better tax break, whether it be a health insurance tax break or just fundamental, just give them, you know, say, hey, you're doing bad this year. We can give you a tax credit or something.
Brian, thanks very much for the call. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
And Michael Duffy, tax reform is on the president's agenda. It's as yet unclear, though, whether there would be winners and losers, and if so, who those would be.
And I think it's also unclear whether they'll actually do it, Neil. Earlier this year, there was some question about whether he'd do Social Security first or tax reform first. They've clearly made the decision to put tax reform later. Later, maybe never. It might be something they could try in the last 2 years. He has talked in the past about lowering rates for everyone and closing loopholes, very much in the realm of a reform that took place in Washington about 20 years ago. There is a coalition probably to do that, but that is not at the moment on the agenda for the next 2 years. They've kicked that can down the road.
Let's get another caller in. Ann is with us on the Democratic line from Santa Rosa, California.
Yes, I'd just like to echo JFK's inaugural speech when he said, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, and just more of an awareness of how much we have in this country, and keeping in mind the social services are being cut and the dwindling middle class and the fact that we consume a quarter of the world's energy resources. I just think an awareness I would like for people rather than to be asking, what more can we get for ourselves? Just an awareness of how much we really have. Thanks so much.
Ann, thank you for the call. The president did speak today to that issue, in a sense. I ask our youngest citizens to believe the evidence of their eyes. He said, you've seen duty and allegiance in the determined faces of our soldiers. Make the choice to serve in a cause larger than your wants, larger than yourself, and in your days you will add not just to the wealth of the country, but to its character. An interesting appeal to public service from the president there, Michael.
Oh, yes, and it was very much a plea, very much a call to very much directed at young people, and a little reminiscent of John F. Kennedy saying, you know, ask not what you can, the country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country. But said, something that comes up in a lot of inaugural speeches, I think Nixon tried it as well, there was a hint of it, Clinton's first, and here again today. Obviously, it was hard to read that line, Neil, without thinking about the military and volunteering for the military, but he also talked about other ways you could help. So it was an interesting line, I thought, too.
Yeah, our diplomats and intelligence services and
that's right.
Things like that. Just a few seconds left, Michael, but a bold speech in its ambitions to end tyranny around the world and to create an ownership society. This is a president that does not lack for ambition.
Oh, no, I was really struck by the altitude of this speech. It was a speech about character and a speech about freedom. I think he used the word 37 times in the speech, and it's not very long, the speech. It was a little bit like a sermon in places, too. Not programmatic, very much about saying, here's what I want to be remembered for. Here's what they're going to judge us by 100 years from now. Let's work on this. Very interesting.
Michael Duffy, thanks as always.
You bet.
Michael Duffy is Time Magazine's Washington Bureau Chief with us by phone from his office here in Washington. More of your calls and a look ahead to tonight's festivities when we're back from a break. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow it's Science Friday. Ira Flato will be here with a look at how different religious traditions view advances in biology and medicine. Can religion and science coexist? Plus what the Huygens probe is revealing about Saturn's moon Titan. That's all tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. Today, it's Inauguration Day, and we're taking your calls about what would help you in your life over the next 4 years. For Republicans, the number to call is 800-344-3893. Democrats, 800-344-3864. We're also taking emails, TOTN@NPR.org. In a few minutes, we'll also be looking ahead to tonight's inaugural balls and checking back in on the parade route as the inaugural parade is almost down Pennsylvania Avenue. But let's get another caller on the line. And this is Linda. Linda's calling on the Republican line from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Hi, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you, Linda.
I'm calling because I'm hoping we'll see major reform in this next 4 years.
I missed that word. Was that tort reform, Linda?
Tort reform, limits on lawsuits. My husband's a physician, and you can know, and patients and people in business, it hurts everybody. He had a frivolous lawsuit hanging over him that ended up dropping, but even these frivolous lawsuits drive malpractice insurance up incredible amounts, and it doesn't drop. We need somebody to limit these lawsuits because the law profession is not going to limit, nor do themselves.
Okay, Linda, we're having a little difficulty with your line, and but we do get your point, and we thank you for your phone call.
Okay, can I say anything else?
Very briefly, because we want to get back to the parade route, if you would.
I wish we went to the Volunteerism Summit a few many years ago. And I'm hoping that they'll do a summit on families and recognize the strength and the value of family in this country and what's good for them.
Okay. Linda, thanks very much. Your line is breaking up, but we thank you for taking the time to speak with us today. Let's turn now to NPR's Luke Burbank, and he's at the parade route near the end of the route at Lafayette Square. Luke, what's going on where you are?
Well, Neil, the president just walked past the president and first lady to very exuberant cheers. It was almost as if the crowd started to do the wave. You could see it a few blocks down, people standing up, cheering, and getting very excited as he walked by. He was beaming.
And an important word there, walked. He did get out of the limousine and has been walking this last part of the route?
At least the part that I'm seeing, he and the first lady were walking, and of course flanked by myriad security guards and Secret Service agents. But I'll tell you, Neil, no sign of any protesters here, although as you attempted to get close to the parade, of course you needed tickets. And at the perimeter where the fences were, there were a number of people sort of with anti-George Bush signs and T-shirts sort of pressed up against the fence. But here it seems to be all people who are very much in support of the president.
And again, you're saying you're not seeing very many protesters there, at least at this point on the parade route.
I haven't seen one. I've seen people holding Texas flags and signs, sort of celebrating the president. But I haven't seen even one sign of anybody showing any dissent.
And what were the cheers for him like? Were they, what, 4 more years, that sort of thing?
You know, there wasn't too much specific cheering, just a general. Like I said, it was interesting because there are so many cars in this motorcade. Of course, everyone is really waiting for one car. So people were sort of straining as each, Trent Lott came down, Tom DeLay, and yet you could tell this sort of rumble started in the crowd as the president got closer. As the rumble got closer to you, it was a sign that the president was getting closer. And like I said, to some people's surprise, he was walking. He was, you know, very much seeming to be a normal guy, kind of strolling down the street.
And looking like he was enjoying himself?
Very much so. I mean, his cheeks were very ruddy. It's cold out here. A lot of the military personnel, you could see them doing their best to be serious, but some of them would have tears of cold streaming down their face, noses running. The president seemed to be pretty vigorous and keeping it together pretty well.
Luke Burbank, thanks very much.
Sure, Neil.
NPR's Luke Burbank at Lafayette Square near the end of the parade route along Pennsylvania Avenue. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is Grady calling on the Democratic line in St. Louis, Missouri.
Good afternoon, Neil.
Good afternoon.
I think the one thing that's been missing throughout the dialogue lately has been investment in education for our children. I think the greatest opportunity we have in terms of security, both in our country and abroad, is by having more well-educated citizens. And I think where we've missed the boat is in increasing the wage for teachers to attract more qualified people into that field.
And you were talking, we missed a word, your phone line dropped out there for a second, but long-term education is what you're talking about?
I'm talking education for the country as a whole, especially elementary and high school.
No Child Left Behind was passed in the first Bush administration.
I think it was crafted in that regard, but I don't think we raised salaries enough for teachers to attract more professionals into that line of work.
Grady, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. The speech is over. The parade is well underway, but the official inauguration parties, well, it's still a few hours till the champagne flows and the dance floor gets full. 9 inauguration balls kick off around Washington, D.C. this evening. There's already been plenty of buzz over the fashion, the food, all the famous folks in attendance. And, of course, all the money is his costing. Here to give us the scoop on the festivities are Robin Givhan, the fashion editor for The Washington Post. She's with us from the studio at The Post. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Hi there. Nice to be here.
And also Roxanne Roberts, style reporter for The Washington Post. She's with us by phone from her home in Virginia. And welcome to you.
No party left behind, Neil.
Robin, before we talk about tonight, last night you were at the Texas State Society's Black Tie and Boots extravaganza. Tickets sold out online in less than an hour for that event. You think it was worth it?
Well, based on the revelry that was going on there, I think absolutely so. It was like an explosion of steer and sequins and cowboy boots and cowboy hats.
A lot of armadillos in pictures in the paper this morning.
There were a lot of armadillo. I think that Texas is one of the few states that identifies itself by its attire.
Tacos, tequila, even livestock there?
Even livestock. Apparently the University of Texas mascot, who's very well known to those folks who follow University of Texas, Bevo. And lots of people were posing with him.
Hook 'em horns, I think, is what you're supposed to say at that juncture.
but I would hasten to add that it was worth it if you got there and you were in the ballroom. I was at the party as well. Robin was in the ballroom, so everybody there got to see the president. There were thousands of other people who wanted to see the president and could get in, and that's a big problem with all the inaugural festivities.
I suspect it is. I don't get to go to these events, but I was riding the Washington subway this morning, and a lot of Stetsons and fur. You don't normally see that on the metro here.
It's fun, though, to see, isn't it?
It's very different, I'll tell you that.
It's one of the things that I'm always impressed with about the Texans is that there is no holds barred. I mean, there is no limit for them when it comes to getting dressed and going full on fabulous and flashy.
I was interesting. I was coming back from Ohio on a plane yesterday. We did the show yesterday from Columbus, Ohio, and it was interesting to see the men waiting for hat boxes on the baggage return at the airport last night. Robin, what about fashion? There's been an awful lot of talk about the First Lady's wardrobe.
Yeah, I think actually what I've seen so far, she's been looking pretty spectacular. I mean, she's absolutely upgraded her wardrobe. I mean, she is dabbling in some of the most high-end designers that can be found on 7th Avenue. And she's also slimmed down a little bit as well, so the clothes just sort of hang a little bit nicer. But she's really gone for clothes that look expensive. I think she's a lot more comfortable being seen as someone who's on a pedestal a little bit.
I don't know if you're getting to see them walk, the First Lady and the President walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. She's wearing what to my uneducated eyes looks like a pretty terrific white coat.
She is wearing a winter white cashmere coat with a matching dress underneath it, and it's by Oscar de la Renta. And Oscar's fashions do not come cheaply.
What about her daughters and the president's daughters, of course, the twins?
The twins are kind of interesting because they're choosing clothes that are some made by sort of well-known designers on 7th Avenue, people like Oscar de la Renta, but they're also going for some new kids on the block. So they're real fashion followers, and I think that's very fresh.
We'll see an awful lot of fashion. I guess we saw some in Hollywood already at the Golden Globes. Of course, the Oscars are coming up. These kind of events are big business for fashion houses, are they not?
Well, in some ways it depends on the fashion house itself, but I mean, this is the kind of advertising that, most of them don't even begin to have the kind of advertising budget to buy. So it's a huge coup for them to get their work out there in front of so many people internationally.
And some people, Roxanne, are not necessarily promoting their products, but themselves. A lot of celebrities are here in town.
Less celebrities of the Hollywood variety than there would be if it was a Democratic inauguration. But it never hurts to get sort of the official stamp of approval from the president and his friends in an inauguration.
So who are we seeing?
Well, truthfully, we saw not a lot, honestly, not a lot of Hollywood power here. There'll be a Creative Coalition after party late this evening, and various celebs are expected, probably some of the Baldwin brothers. But honestly, we don't know who's going to be. Hilary Duff, teen queen, was at the concert, the youth concert on Tuesday. This inaugural is much more about business and money and the top supporters of the president. I mean, you can't go anywhere without bumping into, a top supporter. And that's what inaugurals really, for the most part, are. Hollywood celebrities are sort of like the icing on the cake, but inaugurals are built and created by large donors who support and admire the president.
Well, you do have the governor of California. He's kind of a twofer.
He is a twofer. People are so thrilled to see him. But, here's the fun thing. People come from out of town, and they're thrilled to see the White House chief of staff or cabinet secretary. They always say that this is our version of Hollywood here, mm-hmm. And so the politicians get to be the rock stars for, just the night.
We heard squeals of delight for Tom DeLay along the inauguration route earlier today, something that did surprise me, I have
delight?
To say.
Squeals of actual delight, huh?
Squeals of actual delight.
I think he should savor that moment of being a rock star.
He strode into the Texas ball last night with a hat, a cowboy hat, flanked by about four bodyguards, just in case, we didn't know who he was. That's how he moves around.
Mm-hmm. There is an additional ball that's been added this year. A lot of them are tributes to the military. This is a Commander-in-Chief's ball.
This is, I think there has been a lot of criticism about this inaugural as to whether or not the festivities should have been scaled down. It's privately raised money. It's about $40 million, which is about the same as 2001. But some people said because of the war, because of the tsunami, it was inappropriate to do this. The inaugural committee decided to underwrite what they're calling the Commander-in-Chief Ball. They've invited 200 soldiers who either have just come back or about to be deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq to be there. This is the first time this has specifically happened. The rest of the balls are organized by states. And I think it'll probably be the most emotional of the balls that the president goes to. Usually they drop by, they wave, he does an awkward dance, and it's about a five-minute thing. I'm guessing that tonight that will be the one where all the sound bites and the sort of the emotional moments come from.
Well, Robin, the other thing people say is that there were an awful lot of Republicans who worked hard to reelect the president and they ought to get a celebration. Was that the sense you got last night?
Oh, absolutely. I was going to say that for as much talk as there is about trying to be somewhat more serious or understated, I would almost say that this is the inaugural of fur and big jewelry. I mean, I've never seen so much fur worn head to toe, especially this afternoon, obviously, because everyone was outside and it's quite cold. But I was also struck by the fact that last night, Mrs. Bush was wearing a pretty spectacular diamond and pearl necklace that really makes the jewelry that she wore 4 years ago look like something she might have gotten out of a gumball machine. I mean, this necklace is the kind of thing that, you know, you'd walk around with armed guards behind you when you're wearing.
We'd like to thank you both very much for being with us today. We appreciate you. You're going to have a good time tonight?
I hope so.
We always have a good time. We find ways to have a good time. And plus, let's not take it away. There are many, many millions of people who are thrilled that the president was reelected. This is their night to celebrate. It's the country's night to celebrate that this is a continuation of a peaceful power. So I don't think we can take that part away.
Roxanne Roberts, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Roxanne Roberts, style reporter for The Washington Post, with us by phone from her home in Virginia. Robin Gavon, you have a good night tonight, too.
Thanks very much.
Robin Gavon is the fashion editor for The Washington Post, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go back to the reviewing stand on Pennsylvania Avenue. NPR's Brian Naylor is there, and it sounds like the bands have finally reached you, Brian.
Well, actually, they haven't quite. That was the president's own, the Army band in front of the reviewing stand, trumpeting with a fanfare the arrival of President Bush and Laura Bush in the reviewing stand. They're sitting there now alongside their daughters, and we have the United States Park Police on horseback coming by right now. Still none of the bands yet, but a few moments ago the president stepped out of his limousine, as we talked about, in front of the Treasury building, which is probably the most secure part of the parade route. And he and Laura strolled down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue, surrounded by a phalanx of black Secret Service vehicles. The president wearing a dark overcoat and Laura in a white overcoat, quite a contrast to the black limousine surrounding her. And then just a few moments ago, Vice President Cheney and his wife, Laura...
Lynn.
Forgive me, Lynn Cheney, thank you, did the same thing, strolled down the middle of Pennsylvania Avenue here. And this is where most of the president's fervent backers are. These are the high-priced seats here. And, of course, in the reviewing stand itself are several members of the president's family, his father sitting behind him, former President Bush, and Barbara Bush next to her. Jeb Bush is here.
Governor of Florida, of course.
The governor of Florida. Also another prominent Republican, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, is here, along with numerous senators and members of the president's cabinet, and everybody right now is just kind of sitting and waiting, wondering maybe where the rest of the parade is.
When they get there, as I understand it, each of the acts, if you will, each band, each float, gets to do a star turn there in front of the reviewing stand.
That's right, and there will be a lot of turning. In fact, there are little signs along Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the reviewing stand that say, eyes left. So when these military bands especially come marching by, they know which way they should be facing. There will be, we're told, some 72 bands from representing different military branches, as well as bands from each of the states and floats and all of that. But unfortunately, Neil, that's yet to come, because right now we've just got kind of a lull that the president is in place, and at any moment now we expect we'll see the parade begin in earnest.
Brian, thanks very much. We'll look forward to your coverage on NPR News later today.
Thank you, Neil.
NPR News will continue to cover the parade and all the Inauguration Day events later today. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan.